Blog Talk Radio.
I've been so many places in my life and time. I've sung a lot of songs. I made some bad ones. I've acted all my life in stages with 10,000 people watching. But we're alone now, and I'm singing this song to you. I know your image of me is what I hope to be. I've treated you more kindly, darling, can't you see? There's no one more important to me. Baby, can't you see through me? 'Cause we're alone now, and I'm singing this song to you. You taught me precious secrets of a true love, withholding nothing. You came out in front, and I was hiding. But now I'm so much better, and if my words don't come together, listen to the melody, 'cause my love is in the crying. I love you in a place where there's no space and time. I love you for my life, you're a friend of mine. And when my life is over, remember when we were together. We were alone, and I'm singing this song to you. I love you in a place where there's no space or time. I love you for my life, you're a friend of mine. And when my life is over, remember when we were together, and we were alone, and I was singing this song to you.
Assalamu alaikum, everybody that's out there listening. You're welcome to another episode of Nation Billing. Tonight's topic is Nation Billing Presents Domestic Violence at Home, featuring Sister Mildred Mohammed, the wife of John Mohammed, a.k.a. the Sniper. She's going to be here to tell us first. She's going to give you guys solutions on what to do if you're home. Sister Gidget, take it away.
Okay, first I want to make sure, can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Assalamu alaikum, family.
Wa alaikum salam, ma'am.
Wa alaikum salam.
All All right. In the name of Allah, the beneficent, the merciful, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is his messenger. I greet the nation, building family, and the panel in the true greeting words of peace of As-Salaam Alaikum.
Alaikum Salaam, ma'am.
Alaikum Salaam.
How's everyone's Ramadan going?
Well, it's going fine, sister.
Yeah, right. I know you're sitting there counting the minutes till the sun goes down. Sister Mildred, Ramadan Mubarak, how is your Ramadan coming?
Ramadan Kareem, ma'am, is coming very well. Thank you for asking.
Yes, ma'am. All right, well, Sister Mildred, you know, we all know you, of course, you're known by being the former wife of John Muhammad, the DC sniper, and I know that you have often traveled and shared the story, and that I know that every time that you go and share the story and share your experiences, I know that a part of you has to relive the horror of the moment. So my first question to you tonight is going to be, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing well, by the grace and mercy of Allah. I don't have any nightmares or backflashes or anything like that associated with what I experienced. Allah has truly blessed me and my children to come out of this where we are functioning, we're well. I mean, I tell my story, but I'm emotionally detached from it, and I can talk about it and it not bother me once I'm done talking. So we're doing well.
Well, praise due to Allah.
Praise due to Allah, because that's not the story for everybody.
No, ma'am, it's not. But, you know, I took a lot of time, and I had to be patient with myself and my children throughout all of that, because it was important for me to move forward without the emotional baggage as well as for my children. So for me, we had to be okay. We had to be emotionally well. We have to function in this society, and we have to function where we can make decisive decisions and not be enveloped in emotion. So we're doing well by Allah's grace.
Yes, ma'am. Well, all praise is due to Allah for you and the children. I'm so happy to hear that. Okay, so I guess the first thing I want to ask you.
Excuse me, Sister Gidget.
Yes.
Sister Gidget. Your phone is making this horrible noise. Is there any way you can go to another area of your house where you would get a better signal?
Okay, I'm in the best area for the signal. Can y'all hear me now?
Yes, ma'am.
You can hear me better?
Yes. But it's this noise. So forget it. Would you like a mention?
Okay. Can y'all hear me now?
Yeah, we hear you now.
Okay. Is it clear?
Yeah, now you're clear.
Okay. All right. So, Sister Mildred, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am, I can.
Okay. All right, so I want to know from you, what were the first signs that told you that something was terribly wrong with Brother John and that there was the potential for danger there? What were the first signs?
The first sign was he came back from Saudi Arabia. He was and he was in Desert Storm. He was an 84th combat engineer. He was a demolition expert. And he could make a weapon out of anything. Prior to going to Desert Storm, he was a jovial person. He was happy. He had a direction that he was going in, and he knew exactly how to get there. When he came back from Saudi, he was confused. He was not sure of himself. He was diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and he was not debriefed. So the spiral began at that time. And he was not the man that he was before he left. I mean, before he left, he was, you know, we talked a lot. We talked about our future, how things were going to go. He didn't mind expressing his feelings or how he felt about anything. But when he came back, he was secretive. He no longer wanted me to know what was going on in his head. He felt that everybody was his enemy, and he was not going to allow anyone into his mind to dissect or to analyze what he was thinking.
Okay, so was that prior to him joining the Nation of Islam?
Yes, ma'am. There are a lot of reports that say that when he went to Desert Storm, he was in the Nation of Islam. That's not true.
Yes, ma'am. I didn't think so. Okay.
No, we did not know anything about Islam until 1994, 95, something like that. It was not, we were not in the nation at the time.
Okay. So did you ever seek counseling, or did it ever get to a point where she recognized something was wrong?
No, he did not. I asked him to go and get counseling. At that time, PTSD was not looked upon as it is now, whereas there are soldiers that are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and they have PTSD resources for them. At that time, they did not, so you were pretty much on your own. So, you know, as a wife trying to find out what's wrong with her husband and trying to find ways to make him better, then that is what I did. I tried to find books to read or whatever the case may be to help him through that. But he would not say that that was an issue for him, and he denied the help.
Okay, so when did the initial abuse take place, and in what form was it exacted upon you?
Well, John was not physical. My abuse was not physical. My abuse was psychological, mental, economic, all of the abuses that law enforcement or anyone else don't take seriously. Unfortunately, 80% of victims of domestic violence don't have physical scars to prove that they're victims. So I can tell you that, you know, he tried to make me feel like I was worth nothing. He told me that, you know, it's just a form of mind over matter. I don't mind because you don't matter. He tried to make me feel like I was not worth anything. And that is, those are the typical signs of verbal abuse and emotional abuse. Economic abuse, when we were going through our issues, he gave me $50 to buy food for 5 people. So I had to take that to a spiritual level and say that I'm fasting. That's after we got into the nation. So, I mean, if the abuser is very well liked, if he's a charmer, if he's attractive, or she, and they are people that you look up to, then those around them, you go and say, you know, this person is doing this to me. They're not going to believe you because this person has demonstrated that they are other than what they are at home. And because you don't live with that person, then you take what you see as who they really are, but they're not.
So in order for me to get a better understanding, are you saying that did you attempt to reach out for help, and due to the fact that maybe he was such the charmer, he was, you know, so well-liked that people turned a deaf ear to your cries?
That is correct. John was the life of the party. He was a handsome man. He was athletic. We practiced how to eat to live. No matter what I did or said, he poisoned the well. Poisoning the well means he was telling everybody bad things about me. And because they liked him so well without any investigation, then they believed him. So when he kidnapped our children, there was no outcry. There was, oh, well, you know, he did it to protect his children, and maybe you wasn't the good wife. Maybe you wasn't cooking the way you were supposed to do. Maybe you wasn't practicing your units. Whatever it was, they took his side. And because they took his side, my children were missing from me for 18 months. There was no outcry from me.
Okay.
He took all the money out of the accounts and left me and my mother penniless. Penniless. Nobody did anything for us because I didn't have the physical scars to prove that I was a victim of domestic violence.
Yes, ma'am.
And that happens a lot. 80% is a lot of people. That's a lot of victims that are walking around in pain because no one pays attention to their cry. We have become a visual people where I have to see your pain in order to believe that you are in a serious condition. John did not touch me. John said, you have become my enemy, and as my enemy, I will kill you. John was a man of his word. He said what he meant, and he meant what he said. I was not going to wait around for him to figure out how he was going to do that when I already knew he had the capability, the thought, and the opportunity to make it happen. So just because you don't believe me doesn't mean that it's not happening. Just because you don't see the physical scars or you don't see that the abuse is taking place doesn't mean that it's not. You don't have to have physical scars to be a victim or a survivor of domestic violence. You don't. And if you are being threatened, if you are being abused, then you need to take a look at your relationship and figure out what it is you need to do. I never tell a victim to leave, but I will tell you to plan, because in your planning, you will know when it's time for you to leave.
Yes, ma'am. And Sister Mildred, I was reading some excerpts from your book, Scared Silent. And I think one of the most profound things that was said in that book is when you said that you had two people that you knew you had to look out for. And you had to look out for the DC sniper, and you had to look out for your husband, not even knowing at the time that they were one and the same person. So upon finding out at that very moment, how did you feel?
Well, number one, he wasn't my husband at the time. He was my ex-husband. We got a divorce October the 6th of 2000. Shooting took place October of 2002. I didn't know it was John until ATF and the FBI knocked on my door asking me when was the last time I seen him. And I told them that it was a year ago, September of 2001, at an emergency custody hearing. They took me in to the police station, began questioning me again about what was the last time I seen him. They said, Ms. Muhammad, look, we're just going to have to tell you. We're going to name your ex-husband as the sniper. Oh, by the way, didn't you know you were the target? So I was the target because he was trying to cover up my murder so that once the shootings took place, he would come in as the grieving father and get custody of the children. It was a domestic violence child custody issue. I didn't say I was the target. The police said I was the target.
Wow. So at any time during this process?
I had no idea it was John. None. I knew John was going to kill me. I knew that beyond a shadow of a doubt. I knew it was going to be a headshot because his motto was one shot, one kill to the head. I knew that he was going to find me. That's why before I left the house, I would check the rooftops. I would check the levees. I had to throw my hands up and say, oh, Allah, I got to go to work. Please protect me. I had to walk to work. I knew John was going to kill me and make it look like it was somebody else. Never did I suspect, did I think for one moment during the sniper shooting, it was John. I was looking for two people. I was looking for the sniper, and I was looking for John.
And so when they named him the sniper, what went through
my head? Hit the table. My head hit the table. They asked me, do you think he would do something like this? I peered off into space, and I said, yes. They said, why would you think that? I said, because we were watching a movie. I don't recall the name of it. But he said, I could take a small city, terrorize it. They would think it would be a group of people, and it would only be me. I said, why would you do something like that? And he changed the subject.
Wow. And so during the time when he was going through this, because it's somewhat of a psychosis when a person has post-traumatic stress syndrome, what did the children think? How was he with them?
When he took them from me, he took them to Antigua. He told them that we were all going on a vacation. He was going first, and that I would follow later. They never knew that they were kidnapped until I got them back 18 months later, showed them the website that I had set up, the 800 number I had set up, and then the epiphany came to them that Daddy lied to us all this time. That's when they knew. They had no idea what was going on.
So what ultimately caused the divorce? Because at some point, since you were not married to him during the time he was acting out as the sniper, who initiated the divorce and what was the bottom line for you?
He was having multiple affairs, and I was done. And I told him I want a divorce. He asked me why. I said, well, you acting free? You may as well be free. You don't have to report to me. You don't have to lie to me. You don't have to come in at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning being disrespectful to me and the children. I'm done. And I was done.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Well, before we get into our next round of questions, are there any questions for Sister Mildred? On the line, Caesar. Unmute, Caesar. Can y'all hear me? Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Sister Gidget.
Oh, okay. I thought my phone hung up. Okay, Brother Rakim. Okay, Caesar.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, do we have any questions?
Yes, we have a question. Hold on for a minute.
Okay,
let me cut the mic.
Call out the area code. Just ask me a question.
Caller, go ahead and ask the question, please. Person with the question, ask a question now, please. Okay, I'm going to cut their mic back off. They don't have a question. We can go on. Oh, we lost Rakim. I'm going to call him right back.
Okay. Wow, I'm just, and you know what, Sister Mildred, I thought I knew this story, but hearing you tell it, I'm just in another zone. So now you're divorced, and now he's coming for the custody of your children. So was he ever abusive or physically aggressive with the children at all?
No, ma'am. He was emotionally abusive to them. He told my son that I didn't want him. He told him that the reason why he took them is because I no longer wanted them anymore. I wanted to go on with my life without them. And I loved my daughters more than I loved him. It took a long time for me to break through that psychological training or conditioning that he had set up within my son to hate me so much. And he did hate me, because he really thought that I did not love him. And it took time for me to prove to him. And what I told him, I say, look, I know there are a lot of things that your dad said to you about me, but this is what I'm going to ask you to do. I'm going to ask you to compare what I do to what he said. If at the time you see that I'm doing something he said that I do, then I want you to talk to me so you can understand why I do those things. But if you find that he's told you something that I don't do, then you still want, I still want you to talk to me so that you can understand the truth of it. And that's how we had to deal with that. We had to go straight to the truth. I told him the truth, even if it made me look bad to my daughters and my son. And I told him that's how we're going to make it through this with the truth. So if at any time any questions you have about your dad, I will tell you the truth, even if it makes me look bad. But I did not then, nor do I now, speak badly to my children about their dad. Because regardless of what I feel or how anybody else feels, he is or was their father. And they have a right to love him, and they have a right to their own feelings and the way that they interpret whatever they feel they need to about him.
Yes, ma'am, exactly. And I just want to ask you one other thing, because I'm listening to you, and your case is not so typical as I thought. It's not the classic domestic violence case. You know, there are no beatings, and there's no, it seems to be no isolation, just the mental and emotional and, like you said, financial abuse. And so really, by him not being combative, when you said that it was time to get a divorce, did he fight you in any kind of way? I mean, you know, was he in opposition of you leaving or him having to leave? How did he handle that? Because most men are in that situation are very domineering, and, you know, they try to, you know, inhibit you from doing anything like leaving them. So how did the separation come about, the physical separation of the family?
Well, he left the house. He left the house and went to live with somebody else. I don't know who. He wouldn't give me a phone number. All he gave me was a pager. At the time, we didn't have cell phones like we do now. And so he would come in. He would come in the middle of the night while I was sleeping. But my hearing had become so in tune that I could hear the key going into the door. And so he would come into the house, walk around the bed, peer over to see if I was asleep, stand back up and walk out the door. I had to call a locksmith to have the locks changed. Then he had my phone number changed 5 different times. And each time I got the number changed back, he would call and say, "You thought you got away? You're not getting away from me." So those were the tactics that he used when my son was sick. He pushed his way into the house, and I called the police. The police say, "Well, Miss Muhammad, is his name on the lease?" I said, "Yes, sir, it is." He said, "Well, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do, but you can get a restraining order. The restraining order will prevent him from coming into the house." But when he kidnapped the children, we didn't have a parenting plan. And the parenting plan would have determined who has custody of the children. And since neither one of us had custody of the children, the police said that he had just as much a right to them as I do. So they didn't do anything to try to find them because we didn't have a parenting plan in place.
Wow. Okay, Sister Mildred. Now, another excerpt from your book. It says that okay, we're at the point now where you know he's the sniper. You have been following the story. You know how many people have actually been killed. You know how many people have actually survived, you know, his attempts of murder upon them. And one of your excerpts say that, "Surely people hated me. I thought I was the reason innocent people were killed. A bullet did not take my life, but it would be years before I found my voice. Meanwhile, every gentle word I thought of, I used to help my children heal. That is what a good mother does." So I'm kind of getting, that's where scared silent came from. Did it come from really the shame of you thinking that you were the responsible person of you know, of him committing this act, that you were responsible?
I named my book Scared Silent. I named it Scared Silent because I was trying to stay under the radar so that he would not find me and kill me before I was able to get my children back. I said that the community hated me because they did. People blamed me for what John did. They said if I would have stayed with him, then he just would have killed me. If I would have stayed on the West Coast, then the people on the East Coast would still be alive. Me and my children are not victims because we were not killed. So they blamed me for a very long time. And some of them still do. They still say, how dare you call you and your children victims? You have no physical scars to prove that you are victims of domestic violence. We didn't get help from the domestic violence organizations because the police did not label us victims. And since the police did not do that, then nobody considered us victims. I went to victim compensation to try to get money to help me and my children. They say, Ms. Muhammad, if you don't have any physical scars to prove that you are a victim, there's nothing we have for you but counseling. That's just the way it is. So I had to do all of this on my own. I tried to get counseling for me and my children. Unfortunately, came across unethical counselors who did not want to do anything but know what my children were feeling. And my children said that, Mom, they just want to know our business. So I went to the library, and I got a book on counseling. And I learned how to counsel me and my children myself. Right now, my daughters attend colleges in Ohio. One is 18, one is 19, the other one is 20. Both of them sing opera in 8 different languages. My son works at Sears. He's going to go back to school in August where he will become a computer information systems specialist. He's 22. So they are doing well. They are functioning. It does not bother them. If it does, they come and talk to me because they know I will be honest and I will not judge them or make them feel badly because they express that they love and they miss their dad.
Right. And so, you know, since, you know, a lot of people have this monstrous idea of Brother John Muhammad as being the D.C. sniper, but, you know, let's not forget that he was a human being and that he was someone's son, he was someone's husband, and definitely he was someone's father. So if you would, Sister Mildred, kind of take us back and let us know what kind of brother he was before he actually came back from Saudi, because I want to touch back on that lack of debriefing when you finish. Tell us what kind of man he was prior to going to Saudi Arabia.
Well, John was a man of his word. He said what he meant, and he meant what he said even before he joined the nation. If he felt that there was something that he could not do, that he promised he would do, he had the courage to come to you and say, I'm not able to do that. Can we make some other arrangement and get it done that way? He was a man, he was very skillful in everything that he did. He was like a MacGyver, if you can remember him. He could make a weapon. He could make anything out of anything. He was the go-to guy. He was happy. He was jovial. He loved his children, and at one point he loved me, and I loved him too.
And so he goes off to Saudi Arabia for how long?
3 months. He was there from December of 1990 to March of 1991. That was it.
And he came back in that state?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so there were no services offered to him by, he was in the Army. That was the branch of service, correct?
Correct.
Okay, why did they send him back so soon? Was he just on a temporary assignment, or did something happen?
They didn't send him back. He went to Saudi December of 1990, and he came back March of 1991. He was only gone for 3 or 4 months. They didn't send him back to Saudi.
So did you try to reach out to them for help with him?
Yes, ma'am. But there were no services available. They didn't understand what PTSD was at that time.
Wow.
There were many soldiers that came back diagnosed with PTSD, and there are some soldiers that are still suffering from it. But, you know, if you have a mental log on your record, you will not be promoted. There are many soldiers that are walking around with mental issues, but because they want to stay in the military and they want to make it a career, they're not going to tell their commander that they're having issues. And if you have a spouse that soldier is married to, then that spouse is between a rock and a hard place, because she or he knows that the soldier wants to make this a career. And if I go and tell that something's wrong with him or her, then I'm going to be the object of that abuse. So domestic violence is rising in the military community, and they don't know what to do about it. You're not going to hear about it because it's swept up under the rug. But there are many issues with domestic violence in the military.
So for those soldiers that are coming back, and you know, periodically we hear the story of how different they were before they went into the military and how different they were when they returned, and then we'll hear something bizarre, maybe not as bizarre as your situation, but we'll hear about a bizarre event that kind of let us know that this is related to his military experience. And I was just wondering, were you actively involved in any kind of campaign or any kind of organization to get victims like you were of spouses who have the post-traumatic stress syndrome? Are you involved in any organization to help them get more help and bring more recognition to this issue?
Well, I speak at military installations now, bringing awareness to how important it is for soldiers coming from a war zone to get the help that they need with PTSD. I'm going to Hawaii the end of September to speak at a naval base. I'm going to Fort Detrick in Maryland. I'm going to Fort Myers in Virginia. I've been to Walter Reed Hospital, the Army. I've been to many military installations trying to bring more awareness to domestic violence in the military. I'm going to Fort Huachuca in Arizona in October, Fort Jackson in South Carolina. So, yes, I am, but I also have my own organization called After the Trauma, where we help other victims and survivors of domestic violence as well. A couple of years ago, there was a woman who contacted us. Her mother did, because she had been raped by her abuser for 5 years to have a 3-year-old son. Well, he had diplomatic immunity, and so the police served him with a restraining order. He threw it on the floor and urinated on it. So we needed to get her out of here. I called my resource in Georgia, and we were able to move her from Philadelphia to Georgia, from D.C. to Philadelphia to Georgia, where she had legal representation. She had a place to stay. Her and her son were safe. Well, a couple of months ago, I was in Panera Bread with my daughters, and this woman came up to us and said, "What is your name?" I said, "Well, what's your name?" She told me her name, and she said, "Miss Muhammad, you saved my life." And she began to tell me all the things that happened with her, and I knew who she was, but I didn't know her name. For safety reasons, I don't ask for the names of the people, of the women that I'm helping, because if the police come and ask me, "Do you know this person?" I can honestly say no, but I am protecting the safety of the victim who comes to After the Trauma for help. And we have moved many women from one state to another fleeing for their lives. And this stuff is real. And you don't hear about it on the news, but this happens all the time. I get women who contact me on my Facebook page. "Ms. Muhammad, can you help me? What do you need? How can I help you? This is what I feel Allah has placed on my heart to do. This is what I was spared for, to help other victims and survivors of domestic violence. And I do it all the time. So we have to be mindful that when somebody comes to you for help and they don't have the physical scars to prove it, believe them. Please believe them. If you can't do anything for them, then send them to somebody who can. Google a resource in their area, but help them. Because women just don't say that stuff just to be saying it. Men either, because men are beginning to speak out because they are being abused. That's real.
Yes, exactly. Okay, I want you to talk about after the trauma, but I have one more question pertaining to the sniping event, and then we're going to move on to what you're doing now and everything that you're doing to help people. And then, of course, I want you to share with us all the services that you offer and maybe give information to where people can go get help. But let me ask first, are there any questions from the audience before we move on? DJ Caesar?
No, ma'am.
Okay. All right. So can we get a song on and come back with Sister Mildred?
Yes, ma'am, we can. Hold on 1 second, please.
All right.
Yeah. praying for you.
Sister Gidget, take it away.
All right, let me do a sound check. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right, Sister Mildred. November the 10th, 2009.
Yes, ma'am. The execution date. The execution date.
Yes, ma'am. Tell me what you were thinking and what you were feeling on that day.
My main focus and concern was for my children because their dad was being executed. And it was a very difficult time for them. I had already emotionally detached from John when he said, "You have become my enemy, and as my enemy, I will kill you." So I didn't have any emotional attachment to him. Allah freed me from that. I didn't need him to be executed or to be killed and not move forward. So my concern was for my children. And they did not take it well, of course. My son, when they announced that he had passed, he went into another room with the lights off. My daughter, Kaliba, she fell to the ground and just started crying. And my daughter, Selena, she sat on the sofa whimpering. And I went to each one of them and tried to console them. And they wanted to go to the funeral. So I called my publisher and made arrangements for us to go to the funeral. I did not go in, but they did. And that is how they got their closure. And so once we came back from Louisiana, because that's where the funeral took place, and they were okay. And I could tell that a weight had been lifted from their spirit because now they were laughing and they were free and they just began to blossom.
So, you know, how did that impact them? Because it was such a public event after he was identified as the sniper. So how have they really recovered, and had it been difficult? Has it been difficult for them, even though I know that they're flourishing now? But what was their process for them? Because I understand you told me that you were emotionally detached. So you were kind of like just really moving on and trying to maintain your children. But, you know, how did that process work out for them? Because you said they got closure at the funeral. But surely by now, just like you said, you were hated in the community because, you know, people were putting the blame on you. Certainly the children were feeling some of the blunt of that. So how did that work out for them?
Well, they lost friends. Some friends they lost. Their parents were afraid to have them around my children, which was understandable, and I explained that to them. People are trying to protect their children, and they're not sure of the circumstances in which their children are around them, so they understood that. When I was helping them throughout the whole process, it was the point of them being able to feel, being able to talk about it, being able to express how they felt about their dad without feeling that they were wrong for doing it. When I told them that it was okay for them to love their father because they were hearing he's a monster, he needed to be tarred and feathered, he was unintelligent, he was stupid. I mean, they heard all of these negative things about him. And I set them down. I say, look, what other people say about your dad, that's their opinion. That's that they're basing all of that upon what he did. There's nothing we can do to change that, and we're not going to take responsibility for his actions. So whatever it is you need to express, whenever you need to cry, you just want to say, Mommy, I miss Daddy and I love him. Come and tell me that. Let's talk through this. Let's get through this, but we're going to get through this as a family and we're going to get through this together. That's how I handle that. So even though I say I was emotionally detached, when you hear your children talk about the person who tried to kill you or harm you with love, that's difficult to deal with. But I had to put my stuff aside because my children needed to hear the good things about their dad. They needed to hear what made him laugh, what was funny about him. We watched the home movies with their dad in them, and they wanted to know what was the circumstances around all of that. I had to go through that with them. I had to remember those times for them. And I did that because I love my children, and my children love their father. And regardless of what anybody else says or does, it doesn't matter because he was their father, and they have a right to love him. And I always told them that, and I still tell them that now. My son is a younger version of his dad. He looks like him. He walks like him. He talks like him. He laughs like him. Some of his behaviors are like him. But I don't put him down because of it, because they have both of our genes. I tell him, you know, you look just like your dad in his younger days. And he's happy about that because he has to identify with the male person that was there. And that's who he was. And they love him. And I don't try to take any of that from them. And because I didn't try to take it from them, then they have grown because of it.
Yes, ma'am. And what about the other young man, John Malvo? What about him? Any feelings toward him and his situation? Do you think your husband was able to... Ex-husband, yes, ma'am. Do you think he was able to manipulate him into...
Yes,
becoming...
I did. Yes, he was. He did. Completely, and he was completely manipulated, and he was my children's best friend. When he kidnapped our children and took them to Antigua, Lee was looking for a father figure. Well, John brought him into the house and told my children that Lee is your big brother. So Lee was my children's best friend. So I had to help my children with their father and their best friend. When it came time for Lee's trial, my children came to me and said, Mom, you have to help Lee. If it wasn't for Dad, he wouldn't be there. So I went to his attorneys. My attorney went to his attorney and told them that I would testify on his behalf to try to save him. When I got to the witness stand, Lee's attorney said, Ms. Muhammad, do you recognize this young man? I said, no, sir, I don't. They said, well, Ms. Muhammad, he found you. You see, John sent Lee to your door pretending to be a salesperson. And his instructions were, when you open the door, he was to shoot you in the face and kill you at the door. Ms. Muhammad, you opened the door, but he walked away. We don't know the repercussions he suffered because he did not kill you as John told him to do.
Wow. Yes, ma'am. And through all of that, Sister Mildred, through noticing the dramatic change in him after his return from Saudi Arabia, do you blame the military for the lack of services that they provided to you and your family? Or do you think
they had a hand? They had a hand in it. If I go back to the root of where the beginning started, but John spiraled down, it began when he came from Desert Storm.
Yes, ma'am.
But the military will not hold any responsibility for his actions. The very job that John was trained to do in the military was the very thing he used to execute his plan for killing innocent people.
Right, and I'm saying that even though back then post-traumatic stress syndrome was not as prevalent as it is today, are you saying that as more and more cases are being brought forward and brought to the attention of the armed forces that still they are reluctant in services to the veterans and to the families and to the victims still?
No, ma'am. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the resources that are available now were not available when John came out of Saudi. The resources that they have now are helping the soldiers and their families who are diagnosed with PTSD. They have many organizations, both civilian and military, that have stepped up to try and diagnose it early, to put the resources in place for them. They are able to get compensated if they are diagnosed with PTSD. They are able to go to a health facility in order to help them with their mental issues because they come from a war zone. So they have really stepped up to assisting soldiers that are coming from a war zone with this disorder. That is what I'm saying. The resources were not available then as they are now.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, well, that's good to know. Wow. So, Sister Mildred, After the Trauma is the name of your, well, I know that's the name of your website, right? It's afterthetrauma.org?
That's the name of the organization, yes, ma'am.
Okay, so why don't you tell us something about that? And, of course, we already know your motivation. So tell us exactly what you do and, you know, how can people reach you there?
Well, go to my website, afterthetrauma.org. Then you will see that we try to create a liaison with other organizations in other states. There is a safety plan on that website. If you click on resources, the first line item is a safety plan. Download it, print it out, fill it out. It's comprehensive. Don't take it home. Don't give it to your abuser. Give it to somebody that you trust so that when you are ready to leave, you'll know when to do that. After the Trauma was set up for survivors of domestic violence, but we have had to reach out and assist victims because of the budget cut, and that some of the organizations that were initially helping victims had to close down. So we tried to be that middle woman, man, that would help them with the resources in their area. I just had a sister from Manhattan contact me because she got my book off of a newsstand on the street. She saw my email address in there, which I have my email address in my book in case someone tries to contact me. And she is in a domestic violence situation. She's in a shelter, and she needs help. I contacted some people up there, and they're going to try to help her to get housing. That's what we do. That's what I do. If you contact me on an email, there's a contact link. You email me, I will respond within 24 hours. I don't believe in having people to wait because they are trying to get help because they don't have a lot of time. And if they have the courage to reach out, then I am going to respond as soon as possible and try to get them the resources that they need. That is what we do at After the Trauma.
Okay. And thank you for that, Sister Mildred. And my motivation for having you on the show today is because I personally have a friend that I can't reach her, Sister Mildred. I can't reach her physically, and I can't reach her through the auspices of, you know, calling her or on the basis of friendship or you know, psychologically, I can't reach her because she's gone, so to speak. So one of my motivations for having you on the show is that when you're so afraid, when you're so afraid and when you're so psyched out, and I know it's not, this was not your case, but, you know, she's being severely beaten at times, and she's just afraid. So how do we set ourselves free mentally so that the physical can follow? What would you suggest to women who are in that situation?
If you are being beaten, he no longer cares about you. You have to find someone that is willing to help you. Everybody does not want to get involved when a woman comes forward and says she's beaten because they don't know what to do. They don't know how to move about. If you are listening and you are a victim and you're being beaten and you have access to the internet, email me at afterthetrauma@yahoo.com. All I need is your location and tell me what you need. And I will try to get you the help that you need, but I will not move ahead of you. If you tell me I don't want to leave, I'm not going to make you leave. If you say I just need help to stay, because I get that a lot, then I'm going to ask you to fill out a safety plan and email it to me so that I can have it on record. And if you say, do you have that plan, I can give it back to you. So I can work with you in trying to help you to get the resolution that you need to move out of that situation. Everybody who's being beaten don't want to leave. You can't make people leave if they don't want to leave. You can't give help to somebody that don't want the help. You just can't do it. For whatever reason, that's where they want to be. You just have to let them know that I'm here. I've not left you. Whenever you're ready, you let me know, and I'll be there for you. I'll help you to do what you need to do. And if you feel you don't want to help, then find resources. Get somebody else involved. Call the police. The police are going to say, well, you know, they got to call me. But sometimes the police will go out to just check out the situation. If you feel that's something you need to do, then call the police. I believe this person is being beaten. I want you to go and investigate and look into it. They will go. So don't feel like you're helpless and you just don't know what to do. Call the police if you feel you need to do that, so that that person can get the help that they need, because if it's a physical assault and the police see physical evidence that a physical altercation took place, they will remove her and put her in a shelter, and they will put him in jail. That is an actual fact.
Yes, ma'am. And speaking of the laws, because I don't want to get it confused, because I know there's a stalking law, but, you know, part of that stalking is one phase of the abuse, because once you know you're being stalked, you know, that plays on your psyche. And I just want to know, in your opinion, do you think that the laws that are set up in those situations, Are they enough to deter the perpetrators from actually participating in this type of behavior? I mean, because very few cases make the media like yours and like, you know, Nicole Brown, OJ's ex-wife, whatever. You know, very few cases make the media, but what I see in the community and what I have, you know, been unfortunately blessed to bear witness to at times is that, you know, there's a lack of support, and there are a lack of processes in place to protect victims of domestic violence. So has that been your experience in trying to help others who are in that situation?
Yes, ma'am, that has been my experience, and it continues to be, because budgets have been cut. There are not a lot of resources in helping victims and survivors of domestic violence. It's an ongoing issue, and not a lot of people want to get involved.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Let me see, Sister Gidget.
I'm here. I'm okay. Sorry someone came to the house and frightened my dog. Hold on.
We're going to go to another song while she's doing that real quick.
No, I'm right here.
As I look at my kids, I know they...
I'm sorry
about that. These little children are selling school candy, and I did not expect them to knock on my door. I'm so sorry. Sister Mildred, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so... Well, how do we, how can, you know, people like us who are in the field of social services, how can we go in and offer our assistance via the police department to probably just get some more resources available to people and, you know, like set up hotlines and things of that nature? How does that process work?
Well, the hotlines are set up. The thing is that we just have to get the word out of what those numbers are and who to call, because there's one central number for victims of domestic violence, and that's 1-800-SAFE. And that's one centralized number that's located in Texas, and they will put you in contact with the number, with the organization that will help you in a domestic violence situation in your health, in your area.
Okay. So when I was talking about the laws, were you saying something?
The hotline for domestic violence is 1-800-799-SAFE. They will help you to get the resources that you need in your area.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, so when I was speaking about the laws, you know, they had this anti-stalking law, and they had, you know, different phases of that law that they implemented. I want to know, what about domestic violence? I mean, I understand in your case where there was no evidence of physical abuse, but I have heard over and over again, Sister Mildred, that, you know, there's a domestic violence issue where there's a physical altercation, and the police come, the man is arrested or the woman is arrested, whatever, and then at some point either the charges are dropped or either the victim takes him back. And, you know, sometimes this can go on for years, or it can go on for numerous of times. But haven't the laws gotten any stricter when it comes to a woman or a man filing a charge of domestic violence and then, what, going down there, dropping the charges several times? Has anything changed with that situation?
No, ma'am. The stalking law has become a federal offense. So you have to have 3 incidences before the police will take it seriously. So you have to document the stalking, meaning date and time and the situation that occurred. If you are a victim of domestic violence and you don't have physical scars, the one thing I would tell you to do is document, date and time, the situation, and witness statement. Because sometimes you have to help the police to build your case. That's the laws are not strong enough to hold anyone for a long period of time on domestic violence. It has to have some type of physical offense to go along with the verbal, mental, psychological, and stalking in order for it to take place. That's just where we are. Domestic violence is a relationship issue. And not everybody is willing to put their relationship on the line. Most of the people sometimes are the ones that are in authority and are the ones that are making the decisions on domestic violence. If you have a sheriff in the town that's beating his wife, he's not going to send a police officer out to handle domestic violence issues when it's not a priority, because that's what he's doing. And sometimes that is the case. So if you don't take your own case within your own hands to try to get the help that you need, then you could very well die a victim. But you have to document the situation, and you have to continue to reach out until somebody hears your cry.
Right, and that was one of the things I really wanted to speak to, because I wanted to also speak to the psychological abuse that is taking place, because I asked you that question because I wanted to kind of dwell into how that abuse will make them get to a point to where, you know, they change their minds. You know, they don't want to be away from that person. Once that person is arrested and they're gone overnight, and, you know, even though they're looking in the mirror and they're looking at the cuts and the bruises and the scars, somehow or another, it's almost like they cannot live without that person. And what I was talking about, the intervention on a psychological level, because even though it may be difficult to prove, I think there's enough history with abuse that goes on to say that, hey, she has this particular syndrome because she wants this abuser back in her life. And so how do we, being simple men and women, encourage those that we may know that are involved in a domestic violence situation? What can we say to them to let them know that it's okay to walk away, and that someone will love you again, and that you are worthy of love? How do we reach them, Sister Mildred?
Okay, let me ask you this. The person that you're telling that they need to leave, you got a place for them to go?
Yes, ma'am.
You have a place for them to go? You have finances that they can fall back on, and you're willing to take care of them until they get to where they need to be to move on? Because a lot of women don't have that. And a lot of people stay because they don't have that. And we don't know what he has said to her or him to make them stay. Sometimes as victims, we don't see the abuser for who they are in front of us. We remember when we first met that person. And the person that we first met is the one we continuously look for in the abuser, because we remember what it was like in the beginning. And we don't want to let go of what it was like in the beginning, because that is what made me fall in love with you. So if you are now an abuser, like Maya Angelou said, when someone is telling you who they are, believe them. Believe the person that is in your face right now. Believe the hits, the scrapes, the punches, the drags, the constant insults, the harassment. This is the person that is hurting you, the one that's in your face. And sometimes we don't want to see that person. And the only way you can help me to see that person is to remind me of who it is that I'm looking at. You're not looking at the one you fell in love with. You're looking at the man in front of you. There's a detachment that has to take place, an emotional detachment, before anybody can move from a domestic violence situation. As long as they are emotionally attached, it's hard to leave. Of course they still love him, because, number one, he may be the one bringing home all the money. He may be the one that's making sure that things stay on point. So you take him out of the house, my rent don't get paid for 30 days. My children don't have food to eat. They don't have any clothes to wear. I don't have money to go wash clothes. How are you going to combat that? I want him released. I want to drop the charges. Because she realizes that nobody is going to come to her rescue. Nobody is going to pay her rent. She can't go out and get a job. Social services is not going to step in. That's why they say, I'm dropping the charges. It's a whole lot of issues that are around there. So it's not so easy to say, girl, you know what, if I was you, never tell a person if I was you. Because if you was them, you don't know what you would do. So you have to help them to see their situation from their perspective, not yours. You have to help them to understand what abuse is, because they may think that that's normal. What's normal for one is abuse to another. So we have to look at how they are in that environment. What environment did they grow up in? Is abuse a part of their background? And do they feel that abuse is the only way that they can tell that the person loves them? So it's a lot that goes into that. We got to have the patience to work with them in order for them to understand that they are in an abusive relationship.
Yes, ma'am. And for you, you know, Sister Mildred, by you, you know, you being a member of the Nation of Islam, and you know, we're going to talk family business now, because I don't want people to think that we as Muslims are unrealistic or untruthful. So even though we are taught to marry the FOI, and the FOI is to be the protector of the MGT, domestic violence within the Nation of Islam is very real. And I want to know, in the recovery process, how does faith play a role?
How did faith play a role?
Yes, ma'am. You know, because it's like, in other words, if you have someone who believes as we believe, you know, and as FOI are taught to respect women to the utmost, and then maybe there's an incident that takes place and there's some domestic violence there, does it put a question mark on your faith? Do you question his faith?
There was never a question mark on my faith. I know that if it were not for the teachings of the Unblemished Muhammad, I would not be alive and of sound mind and body now. When I went through all of that, I had my Quran, I had the Bible, I had my study guides, and I had my journals. That's how I made it through. I had to pull away from other people's opinion, because had I listened, I would be dead. If I listened to what other people say that I could, should, or would do, and they are not living in my house, then you are not qualified to tell me what I could, should, or would do. You have to, as the minister tells us, to look to the leader within, because it is the leader within that will help you to get through those situations that you need to get through. I had to rely on myself and Allah. That's all I had. I couldn't trust nobody, because I didn't know who was on John's side. I didn't know who would go back and say anything to him. You have to trust, and you have to know that you know that you know who God is. You have to know that Allah says in the Quran that he is as close to you as your jugular vein, and that's in your neck. So you are never alone. So if you know who God is, and you know that this is not going to last a very long time, then you have to stay rooted in your faith and know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he will bring you through. That's how I made it out. I would not have been able to make it out of that without Allah. I just would not have been able to do that. And I would be remiss in my duty if I did not acknowledge that if it were not for Allah, I would not have made it through. I did not do all of that on my own. I prayed and I asked Allah to put people and resources in place to help me, and he did. I don't go to people first when I need help. I go to Allah first, and then Allah will direct those people who he will send to help me by letting me know that they have spoken a word that I will recognize, that I said in my prayer that I need those people to say, so that I will know that they came from him. But my faith was strengthened. I don't question anybody's faith. John's faith was John's faith. That's his walk with Allah. My faith is what brought me through to where I am now.
Yes, ma'am. And, you know, I just want to say, the reason why I'm asking you about faith is because sometimes we can get caught up in what we know we believe and what we know we have been taught. So everybody is in awe when they hear that, you know, an FOI may have been aggressive towards a female, or a female, you know, an MGT may have been aggressive towards an FOI. And I just want them to know that it's not impossible. It's not impossible, and it does happen. But there are answers. There are resources. And I know your story, Sister Mildred, as, you know, like you were saying, how John was the life of the party. So he was actually able to manipulate how people looked at him. And so no one would even imagine with the personality he displayed that he was, you know, this particular type of husband. At home, even though he wasn't physically abusive, no one ever got that idea. So all I'm saying is that my sisters, to my sisters, if you are having this problem, you have one of your own. I'm here. Sister Mildred is here. There are many other sisters who work in this field who provide these services. You do not have to suffer in silence. To my brothers who are dealing with that situation, do not get so macho where you do not reach for help. Because one of two things is going to happen. You're going to get severely hurt, or you're going to be pushed to the brink to where you're going to severely hurt somebody, and no one is going to understand. They're just going to look at you as the man, and that evidently you were the aggressor, and you're really the victim. So, you know, do not be silent on this. And, yes, it does happen in the Nation of Islam. I'm sorry. That's the truth. I can bear witness to it. I want to tell anybody inside the nation, outside the nation, get in touch with Sister Mildred. Hit me up the Nation Building Hotline. Get any kind of help that you can for this situation. Okay, so Cesar, we're going to check the lines and see if we have any questions.
Let me say this: if you are in the Nation of Islam and you are an MDT and you are a victim of domestic violence, report it to your captain. Use the chain of command. It works. If you are the abuser, male or female, if the brother is being abused by his wife, because it happens, report it to your captain. Follow the chain of command. Let them help you, because that's what they're there for.
Yes, ma'am.
And domestic violence doesn't have a religion. It doesn't have a social status. It doesn't have an educational or financial status. It happens to men, women, and children, and we just have to recognize it, and we have to help each other through this, because if we're family and domestic violence does tear at the fabric of the family, then we have to help each other. Not all brothers are abusers. Not all sisters are abusers. But those who know who they are need to check them and need to report them, because we can't build a nation if we're building a nation of abusers.
That's right. Season?
No, ma'am, we don't have anything right now. We had some, but those people, they went on. I got a question for you, Sister Muhammad. I know that you're in the media there all the time. Can you tell me, like, I know you've been on CNN, I've seen that. What do you think about the media coming at you and always asking you questions, like, about your husband? I mean, that was your... You have nothing to do with that. So what do you think when they put you in a situation and they ask you questions about your husband when you're not him?
When they ask me, and he's my ex-husband, ask me questions about him in reference to what?
And to the killing the people.
I don't answer questions that will try to interpret or analyze what he's done. I know that they have questions that will try to make me do that, but I'm grateful to Allah that he has given me the skill where I don't fall into that. That was one media outlet that the National Enquirer wanted me to interview. They interviewed me, and they asked me, Why did John come here? Did he come to shoot the president? I said, no. Did he come to, was he a part of some black militant group? I said, no. Well, is he a part of some black Islamic militant group? I said, no. My attorney stopped the, well, they stopped the interview, and he said, my attorney came over and he said, look, a wonderful job, but this is what we need you to say. We need you to say that Minister Farrakhan told John to shoot those people. Can you do that?
Wow.
I didn't say anything. So they started the interview again. And they said, was John a part of some black militant Islamic group? I said, no. They said, well, did someone send him to shoot innocent people? I said, no. They stopped the tape again. They told him, my attorney, you need to go and confer with your client. We get outside, and he says, Mildred, in order for you to get $65,000, you need to say that Minister Farrakhan told John to shoot those people.
Wow.
I said, you can go and tell them that I was broke when I walked in here, and I'm going to be broke when I walk out. Nobody is going to get me to put the head of the minister on a silver platter and serve it up for 30 pieces of silver. So
wow.
I know what they were trying to do. When the police pulled me in, they said, look, we know you follow Farrakhan, okay?
Yeah.
So this is what we need you to do. We need for you to tell us all of the names of the people in the mosque, because all of y'all carry the name Muhammad, and we don't know who they are. Can you help us with that? No, sir, I cannot. I cannot
right.
help you. Well, Ms. Muhammad, we're just trying to help you. Really? I don't think you are. Well, why would you say that? Because your FBI agent said they wanted to put me in the middle of a parking lot and use me as a decoy so that they could lure John out. But we just want you to answer questions frivolously. Oh, I don't think so. Because, see, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that we are only supposed to answer the questions that are asked. So unless you have a question to ask me, I'm not going to talk frivolously. They were very frustrated with me because I would not cooperate with them. So I know Allah prepared me for the media. They just can't come at me with anything. The documentaries that you see, they wanted me to walk down the street where the victims were shot. I say, no, ma'am, I'm not doing that. We need for you to put your prayer rug down on the floor, use the Quran to pray so we can capture you because your faith was a big part of what you went through. No, ma'am, I'm not doing that. But, Ms. Muhammad, you being really, you know, you're not cooperating. I say, look, let me say this. There are many victims of domestic violence out there. You don't have to film me. There are plenty of them. If I don't stand my ground as to what I believe and what I will or will not do, yes, the media will bombard me, and they will say what they think they need to say. But because I don't, they respect me for that. So they can't come at me with questions about John, and I don't have to answer.
Yes,
ma'am. And sometimes I don't, because he is my children's father. I have to be careful what I say about him. Because he's my children's father. Once I'm dead and gone, my children would have this to live with. They are not going to be punished for something that I said about their father that they are going to have to try to defend. No, I'm not leaving that for them to do. I'm very careful with what I say and how I say it.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. All praises due to Allah. We have so much respect for you, Sister Mildred, but, you know, it really sticks in my craw that after everything that you were going through, now they wanted you to put on an act, and now they wanted you to bring forth the minister so that they could, in the midst of your misery, try to capture our minister too. But I'm going back down, and we're going to move on to something else before I really turn my head piece another way. So, Sister Mildred,
But see, that's how they get us, when they know that we need money. I didn't have no, you have to understand, I had no money. I had nothing. It was me and my children. We had nothing. Absolutely nothing. I had people to tell me, girl, you crazy. I wouldn't have turned down no $65,000 for nobody. But see, you not me. I'm not lying on nobody just to have a few pieces of silver. That's not how I'm made up. I don't do that. I'm not doing that. We didn't have food. We had nowhere to go. We had no place to live. It's no way I was going to do that. It's just, you can't entice me with money. Money, you know, money is money. Allah will bless me. That's how I look at it. We don't have it now, but Allah will bless us to get it later. We're just going to keep it moving.
Yes, ma'am. Wow. Okay, well, another way you're going to keep it moving, Sister Mildred, is that I hear that you have a new book coming out. So can you give us a scoop on the new book?
Well, the working title is After the Trauma, and it's just picking up where Scared Silent left off, which is about the execution and how to live from day to day as a survivor of domestic violence, how to pull from the different people and resources to help you to make it through it, because it's hard to be a survivor of domestic violence. Some people think that just because you're out of it, you're no longer in trouble. But that's when you need the most help, because if you are out of it and you don't get the help, you end up going back into that abusive situation. So my book is to help to bring more awareness to other resources that are available that can help you to stay out of that abusive relationship.
Yes, ma'am. And Sister Mildred, I know that you are an advocate, and I know that, you know, a lot of people call on you, but I just want to know, what is the frequency? Are you getting called about cases every day or several times a day, or is it just every now and then someone is reaching out to you? Because I know domestic violence goes on every day, and of course, you know, there are hotlines and there are other shelters and places that are set up. But I'm saying, because of you and because of who you are and because of your story, how often are you contacted about a domestic violence situation?
Every day. Sometimes twice a day. But they contact me through email. And when they contact me through email, then I work better because I can give them the resources that they need. I can put them on a listserv of other organizations that work with me or that I work with as well to get them the resources that they need. So it's every day. It's on Facebook. It's Twitter. It's email. You know, sometimes I get, my friends will call and say, look, I got a friend who's in a domestic violence situation. Please call her because she's not listening to me. I say, well, have her to call me because that way I'll know she wants the help. Sometimes they call, sometimes they don't. But this is what I do. And the pace is picking up because October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And so the calls are coming in pretty frequently now.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I can tell this is your passion, and you know, I can tell that this has been a motivational force for you, and I understand, and I share your sentiment in a lot of ways. So, Sister Mildred, tell us how we can get in touch with you again. I know it's afterthetrauma@yahoo.com. That's one way. And
you can contact me on Facebook, Mildred D. Muhammad. The D does not have a period behind it. You can go to my, I have three pages. One is for After the Trauma on Facebook. The other one is Scared Silent. And the other one, the third one is Mildred D. Muhammad. You contact me on either one of those, I will get back in contact with you immediately. I'm always on it. It's always up. So if you contact me, I'm going to email you back. Tell me what you need, and we'll go from there.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. I think I have one more question for you. And when is the book scheduled to come out?
I don't know. I'm still working on it.
Okay. And
probably in 2013, though.
I'm sorry?
Probably next year, 2013.
Okay. So, Sister Mildred, how long do you think you're going to do this? You think this is like your life's mission now?
Yes, ma'am. This is my life's mission.
Okay. So do you plan to open up any shelters on the East Coast or anywhere, anytime soon?
I'm not doing the shelter thing for someone else. I am going to be the one that moves you from place to place. After the trauma has been pegged as the Underground Railroad, so we will get you the services that you need. We will help you to get information about shelters in the area, and we work with shelters because shelters are filling up fast. Transitional homes and shelters no longer have space available. And now they're putting women out like in a 30-day process, and that turnaround time is not enough time for a woman to get her bearings together as to what it is that she needs to do. So we're just here to help as much as we can. I will be striving to open a one-stop for after the trauma where you can come in and get everything that you need in one place versus going to different organizations that's scattered all over the place.
Okay, so is it something that is privately funded, or are you a 501c3? And if you take
After the trauma is a 501c3 organization.
Okay, and do we go to the website if we want to donate?
Yes, ma'am. Go to and click on donate, and you will receive a receipt that you have contributed, and you can use it as a tax write-off at the end of the year. And I hope those people who are listening will donate, because we are moving a lot of women and children, and we are helping them as much as we can. And because the government is cutting services to many organizations of domestic violence, we are scrambling big time for money to help. So whatever you donate will be of such value that we can continue the work that we're doing.
Okay. And what about advocates that can assist you? Is there any way that anyone can help you, do this work? Because I don't know how often you're inundated with clients, but how can we further help you in what you're doing?
You know, if you could just, when someone comes to you for help, help them. Even if it's not my organization, help them to get to the person that they need to for help. Don't turn your back on them. Don't leave them in the wilderness crying for help, and you know that they need help. That's how you can help after the trauma. That's how you can help me, by not turning people away that need help.
Yes, ma'am. All right, this is my last call for alcohol. Are there any more questions out there?
No, ma'am.
All right, Brother Rakim. Did we lose him?
Probably has his phone on mute. Brother Rakim, turn your phone off mute, please. Okay, Brother Rakim, I see him still on, but he's not responding.
Okay, yeah, he's probably getting ready to break his fast. All right, well, that's going to be the end of our show. Sister Mildred, thank you so much. I know you're oftentimes asked to speak and asked to appear on different shows, so we are honored to have you tonight. I really thank you for taking time outside of your schedule, your busy schedule, to come on Nation Building. I want to send a special thank you to, I don't know her last name, I've been talking to her all week, to Coretta. Is that right, Coretta?
Coretta Allison.
Okay, yes, to Coretta. Coretta, you're a queen. Thank you so much for helping. I also want to thank again Alvin and Tanika Harmon, as well as Brother Marcus Muhammad, for sharing their experience in domestic violence, because that has kind of been our topic all week. And I want to thank Brother Rakim. He was on the phone. He is our founder and chief executive officer of Nation Building. And to Sister Marilyn and Brother Derek, our other admins, I want to thank some special people, DJ Black Caesar, who is our engineer, who without him none of this would ever be possible. Thank you, Caesar, for always being the constant professional. And I want to say thank you to the love of my life, Richard, and I want to thank you to Brother Jason and all of my brothers from Muhammad Mosque number 7 in New York. All right, Sister Mildred, any last minute advice for us?
If someone comes to you as a victim of domestic violence, help them. Don't turn them away. If you don't know what to do, give them my email address, and I will pick up where you left off.
Yes, ma'am.
My email address is afterthetrauma@yahoo.com.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
We have afterthetrauma@yahoo.com, and we have Mildred Diaz and David, right?
Yes, ma'am. Muhammad.
And then we have afterthetrauma, and that, these are all the Facebook pages. It's Mildred Diaz and David Muhammad, After the Trauma, and then we have Scared Silent. All of these are Facebook pages where you can be reached. afterthetrauma@yahoo.com is your email where you can be reached, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. We didn't miss anything, did we? Because we want to make sure we get your information out there.
No, ma'am. Everything was covered.
Okay.
Sister Mildred Muhammad.
Yes, sir.
I really enjoyed the show tonight. I'm glad you came on. It was an honor to have you here. And I went to your Facebook page. You have a likes page also. I went to the likes page and I liked it, and I left you some little messages in there. So when you check out your show, when you check them out, I would like to get you on my show also. I have a show that comes on Wednesdays. It comes on at 7 p.m., and I'll get back to you and let you know what it is, all right?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and Nation Building has shows on Sunday, which it used to be our relationship show, but this is relationship, so it was domestic violence this Sunday. But we're on Sunday at 6:30 p.m. Central. We're on Tuesdays with the Real FOI. This week they're talking about technological warfare. That's going to be at 8 p.m. Central on Wednesday.
We didn't get any of that because I think somebody had their radio on, I mean their internet on, and it was a lot of feedback. We didn't hear you on those last words you were giving.
Okay. Okay. All right. I was just given the schedule of the show. So on Sunday, we have a relationship show at 6:30. On Tuesday, the real FOI will be on starting at 8 p.m. this week. It's Technological Warfare with Brother Richard and Brother Jason, Ed Kalori Muhammad. On Thursday, we're going to have Brother Southwest Regional Student Minister Robert Muhammad. Okay, I'm getting some feedback. What is that noise?
Okay. I don't know, but I just canceled Raheem's phone out, and I think that's where it was coming from.
Yeah. Okay, so this coming Thursday, Southwest Regional Student Minister Robert Muhammad, as well as Eastern Regional Minister Abdul Hafiz Muhammad, are going to sit down and we're going to talk Table Talk 2012. So August the 4th, the Keys is coming back with their first show of business and technology. So we have a lot of stuff coming up, a lot of stuff going on. So I know we've got something that's going to suit your fancy, and I just thank the audience for listening. Sister Mildred, thank you once again. I can't thank you enough for being so informative, for sharing your story, and just providing information, but most of all, for what you continue to do for people who are victims of domestic violence. So, sister, I salute you, MGT to MGT. Thank you so much, and I hope to have you back again sometime in the near future, no matter what it is. I just love your spirit. So thank you so much. And
good
night, Nation Building family. Thank you, DJ Caesar. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum salam.
As I look at my kids, I know they miss their mama. Since I got out the pen, been through so much drama. It choked my daughter up to tell me what she went through. While I was doing time, I couldn't tell you. I remember that first day walking in my home. It looked all abandoned. I felt so alone, holding my kids' hands, and they looked up at me. I had to let her go. That's how it's gotta be. Fast forward 2.5 years, my baby's here. Living good, right direction, daddy gotta steer. Economy is bad, the money's even worse. Hated my mama giving hundreds to me out of purse. Yeah, I'm mama's baby, but it drive me crazy. College graduate, yet nobody wants to pay me. My own family played me. Girl, you broke my heart, but that encouraged me to see success about to start. Yeah, I got this music touch your inner soul, and pray to be the tool that closes up the black hole. But at the same time, I gotta do my first job. Got my children not to thrive on being heartthrobs. I can't let them go, God. Let them stay with me. When I hit my knees, I let them pray with me. Watch their movies with them. Let them lay with me. And tell the truth on every track until that day hit me. Yes. When the Lord takes me away, I truly did my best. That's all that I can say. And pray my good deeds outweigh my shortcomings. In this real music, I hit the court running. Yeah. To the Lord take me away, I truly do my best. That's all that I can say. And pray my good deeds outweigh my shortcomings. In this real music, I hit the court running. Times got better, but it's still hard. I know it's about to change. I can't fall apart. My woman's stressing out. I know I played a role by being selfish, but you helped me got a heart of gold. I learned to let my ancestors guide my right hand. When my pen move on paper, see that light, man. In the booth, I leave frost on the mic stand. One of the reasons why they call me the Iceman. Life lessons, they be hard on the king. But you gotta face them or your crown will only be a dream. My star alignment at my birth was the gift. Blessed to speak to your soul, I enrich and uplift. They say your struggle's depth determines success height. If so, I find success through my struggle on the mic. Can't look in my kids' eyes and let them see this pain. So I put it on the disc for the world, entertain. Yeah. When the Lord takes me away, I truly did my best. That's all that I can say. And pray my good deeds outweigh my shortcomings. In this real music, I hit the court running. Yeah. To the Lord take me away, I truly do my best. That's all that I can say. And pray my good deeds outweigh my shortcomings. In this real music, I hit the court running. I have only one wish in this world, to leave a legacy for my boys and my girls. Make sure my life meant something more than just the money. You may see me crack a smile, but ain't nothing really funny. Why? I got 2 sticks and a stone trying to build a castle. Mephistopheles asked, is it worth the hassle? Well, I'd rather leave the truth than a lot of y'all. The first time I ever let my pen cry for y'all. Yeah. When the Lord take me away, I truly did my best. That's all that I can say. And pray my good deeds outweigh my shortcomings. In this real music, I hit the court running. Yeah. To the Lord take me away, I truly do my best. That's all that I can say. And pray my good deeds outweigh my shortcomings. In this real music, I hit the court running. Thank you.